Welcome to 1 Samuel 18. I've entitled it David's Prosperity Gospel, where Saul becomes fearful and jealous of David's success. So let's look at 1 Samuel 18 for a little bit. The context is David kills Goliath and is brought before the king. That's towards the end of chapter 17. David's success is all over chapter 18. What we should notice is that both 17 and 18 are closely linked. At the end of 17, David is brought before the king and is formally introduced after what Saul had seen David do in the field. And in 18:1, that conversation is ended. So they are closely linked. So there's different opinions among people who where the chapter ends. Certainly the question, whose son are you, young man, in verse 17, 55 through 58, is the beginning of what happens in chapter 18. So David finished speaking to Saul in 18:1. There are others that argue that 1 through 5 introduce key themes in chapter 18, especially the love for David by so many of the people, except for Saul. And I think both are true. It's closely linked to the previous chapter, and yet it introduces some key themes for chapter 18. And following chapter 18 and David's success, which is very shortly lived in Saul's eyes, there is Saul's pursuit of David, which continues from chapter 19 on to his death in chapter 31. Well, Saul's fear and jealousy of David's successes, let's start there. Verse 1 through 4, David becomes part of Saul's family. And then in 5 through 9, Saul becomes jealous of David's successes. Saul tries to kill David in verse 10 through 16. Saul gives Merib to Adriel, the Meholathite, in 17 through 19. And Michal becomes David's wife in verse 20 through 29. And we find that Saul becomes David's enemy for life in verse 30. So let's read the first four verses as David becomes part of Saul's family. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own son. And Jonathan stripped him of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. What's going on here? Well, what's not to love? As one writer puts it in this chapter, everyone apart from Saul, that is, loves David. Verse 16, 20, and 22 are some examples of this. Jonathan in verse 1 and 3, all Israel and Judah in verse 16, Saul's daughter Michal in verse 20 and 28, Saul's servants in 22. Saul had loved David greatly in chapter 16, but no longer in chapter 18. There we go. Michelangelo's a vanity shot of David at the Vatican, I believe. Well, David was immediately given status by his relationship with the royal family. So from 17, he's fit for watching his dad's sheep. He doesn't belong in the battlefield, according to his brothers, oldest brother. And now he is part of the royal family. So what is Jonathan's response to David? It seems pretty impressive, but notice that Jonathan takes the initiative as socially superior. He became one in spirit with David, loved him as himself, made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself, took off the robe he was wearing, gave it to David along with his tunic, sword, bow, and belt. Notice who takes the initiative. It is Jonathan throughout. Well, Jonathan was the king's son. He was much older and much higher in status. He was also a military hero. And David was not old enough for military service. Many reasons why Jonathan takes the initiative. Why is this so important? Well, God had rejected Saul's dynasty in chapter 13, verse 13 and 14, and kingship in verse 15, 26 through 29. Both had initiated faith-motivated attacks against military superior Philistines that had resulted in great victories for Israel. For Jonathan, look back to chapter 14. These guys were both heroes. They had something in common. Well, let's see a little bit more about the response. He was knit to the soul of David. Great affection. Jacob's love for his youngest son, Benjamin, is phrased this way in Genesis 44. His life is bound up in the boy's life. Same idea. Metaphorically, it could be used of conspiracy or conspiring together, which turned out to be Saul's view of Jonathan's relationship with David in chapter 22. But he loved him as his own soul, verse 1, verse 3, and 20, verse 17. So whatever happens to David, says Gagnon, happens also to Jonathan. If David hurts, Jonathan hurts. If David rejoices, Jonathan rejoices. Consequently, if David becomes king, Jonathan has every reason to rejoice. What an amazing friendship that they had. Well, he was committed to their friendship. He formally solemnized or promised or swore twice by agreements of loyalty with David in chapter 18 here, and then in chapter 23, 18. So what is Saul's response to David? Not like Jonathan's. And Saul took him, basically conscripted him. The one who defeated Goliath needed to be in his army. It goes on to say, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. Remember Samuel's warning about a king like the nations, which Saul became. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders, chapter 8, verse 11. And that's what he did with David. Well, it was a long-term service that day and would not let him return, the scriptures say. It was the beginning of a long period of service by David until Saul chased David out. Well, Jonathan not only loved him and was knit to him and committed to him, he also offered gifts. He offered David his robe. He was, in fact, transferring his own status as his heir appointment apparent to him. If you recall, Samuel and Saul split, and as they split, the robe is torn, and it symbolizes, according to the prophet, that the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day, chapter 15, verse 28. But he also gives him his armor, sword, bow, and belt. If you recall, in chapter 17, Saul had tried to put his tunic and armor on David, sort of like a little Goliath, if you will, 17, verse 38 and 39, but to no avail. It was not tested. It did not fit, so David did not keep it as he ran out to battle. But Jonathan now gives his own tunic and armor, including a type of belt that was used to hold a sheathed dagger, according to 2 Samuel 28, to David, who apparently accepts it without further ado. Gunn makes this comment, David can receive from Jonathan what he cannot receive from Saul. What an amazing friendship. It also represents his abdication. It showed that David's claim to the throne was not revolutionary or based on sheer power. Instead, David's pursuit of the kingdom was based on Jonathan's relinquishment of his position, according to Lehart, and I think he's right. Well, let's look at this bit of success that Saul becomes jealous about, verse 5 through verse 9. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines of songs of joy and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they ascribe thousands, and what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that time on. What Let's take a look at these successes briefly. Well, David was punctilious. That is, he went out, he was on time, he understood in the context of referring to military exploits. So he did his job. He did his duty, if you will. David prospered. We see that in verse 5, 12, 14, 28, and 30. And we discover why when you look at verse 12, 14, and 28. It was because the Lord was with him. And David was promoted. Saul set him over the men of war. So he's moved up in the military thanks to Saul's promotion. Goliath was labeled a man of war in chapter 17. And here David is set over the men of war. Possibly more of an administrative position to be contrasted with the post given to David later on in chapter 18, which suggested a field command with active duty. So he's moving in the right direction to active duty. Furthermore, the people and Saul's servants were pleased. They were pleased with what had taken place with David's success. Literally, the phrase is, was good in the eyes of. So it was a song that was, or promotions that were accepted. Well, there are songs in verses 6 and 7. They are expressions of joy. The form, literally the expression of joy. And you'll find in Exodus and Judges and Psalms and among many of the ancient Near Eastern traditions, women traditionally composed songs honoring military victories. So this was a song expressing joy at a military victory. And the manner they were singing to one another. So on one side of the street, perhaps they were singing, and on the other side, there's a response from that group. Well, the interpretation by Saul, or by the interpretation of this song, well, Saul struck his thousands, David his 10,000s. It comes up in chapter 21. It comes up in chapter 29. It comes up one other time, I think, before Achish, the king of one of the Philistines. Well, Saul is mentioned before David. That's important because it puts Saul first priority, but they're in the same song, so it suggests equal treatment with the king. So it implies that David might be a rival to the king. If we recall chapter 15, 28, with the prophecy, or the prophecy by Samuel that a neighbor would be appointed king, and Saul has to wonder if David is that neighbor because of his success. Well, David struck down only one enemy, Goliath, which makes the math sound kind of interesting. But his soldiers in 2 Samuel 18 say that David was worth 10,000 of his men. So perhaps the song is more literal than we think. Well, God is not praised in this song. If you notice, when you compare it with the song of Miriam in Exodus 15, with the women of Israel after the destruction of Pharaoh's host in the Red Sea, when Miriam sang, "Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea." No praise was devoted to Moses, who had stretched out his hand over the Red Sea so that it parted, because the people knew that the power and the glory belonged to God alone. It generally reveals a low spiritual level when Christians take after the world and praising men instead of God, says Phillips. I think that's a good point to raise at this point. Well, Saul's expression of anger is expressed in 8 and 9. Saul was very angry. It was literally evil in his eyes. It galled him. The reason, well, as Saul interpreted, is that David killed 10 times more than Saul did, 10,000s or myriads. It presents David's accomplishment as greater than the king, Alter suggests, but it is a standard way of expressing a very large number in parallel lines of poetry. So in Deuteronomy and Psalm, a couple of places in Psalms, the same idea is carried on where the smaller figure is mentioned first and then the larger figure is in parallel. So it may have not actually been suggesting that David was 10 times better, but it comes across that way to Saul, and that's what matters in this chapter. Well, the risk Saul immediately sees is, what more can he have but the kingdom? Saul prophesied that the kingdom would be given to someone else, as we noticed earlier, a neighbor. So there is the jealous eye, the suspicion that we have a rival here that Saul must pay attention to. Vannoy says this: from the very first day that Saul retained David at the court after his victory over Goliath, he suspected that David was the person whom the Lord had chosen to replace him as king. Interesting. All this love about David's success, and already within a day of his return to the court from battling Goliath, he is under suspicion. Fame is fleeting, isn't it? How about some applications? Fee suggests this: that Saul can only fear David for his success rather than embrace him for it, as the people in Saul's family do. Shows the king's attempt to deny God's rejection of him. So he's had 3 chapters to get used to God's rejection, and he has not done so. Well, Saul's continued desperate grasping for power cannot thwart God's continued tearing of the kingdom from him. A certain eventuality symbolized in Saul's own tearing of Samuel's robe in chapter 15. One other note from Leithart. First, with one exception, 24:1-7, David did nothing to harm or attack Saul in the slightest degree. He never returned evil for Saul's evil, but instead did good service to Saul even when he was being attacked, hounded, and harassed. He always did homage to Yahweh's anointed. Wow. Well, in verse 10 through 16, there are Saul's attempts to get rid of David. Let's read that. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had a great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all the Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. Well, let's look at this first attempt. It's the very next day after the homecoming. The mental state of Saul is important. The previous day, he had been very angry and jealous of David because of the song. And now it works itself out in an action as he tries by various means to cause David's death. And we'll see several more as you move through chapter 9 and to the end of, almost to the end of Samuel. Well, ecstasy is represented here. Saul raved, so the same word for prophesied, inside his house in chapter 10:13, before the prophets. But here it's in the courthouse, and it's a different experience. Well, the intended victim, of course, was the musician. David was playing music to help Saul, as he frequently did. And what begins as anger and jealousy moves to murderous and irrational fear. So it becomes a very serious situation. Well, let's look at that attempt a little bit closer, perhaps. He had a spear in his hand. We'll find that Saul often has a spear in his hand in chapter 20, verse 33, 22, verse 6, 26 through 7. So he has the means. And the motive: I will pin David to the wall. Well, the idea to pin David to the wall is to pin David to the wall by going through David. It's through his body, so that the person cannot move. It's not just the cloth. Well, we've got the evidence, of course. There are 2 holes in the wall, apparently, either 1 or 2 spears that were pinned to the wall, and David was rushed off. Well, a harmful spear from God rushes upon Saul in this bit. We find that it's repeated The idea is that this spirit is sent to torment, terrorize, or terrify Saul. And we find it in chapter 16, 18, and 19. It might not be all the occasions, those that Samuel records. Well, what was it? There are many attempts to come up with an idea as to what caused this harmful spirit. Was it a guilty conscience? Melancholy? It was not the Holy Spirit. The spirit had been withdrawn and given to David. Was it a demon? That seems to be a popular view. The source, it's described as from the Lord in chapter 16. It's described of God in chapter 16 in two places, in 18, and it's described as of the Lord in chapter 19. So if nothing else, the Lord is using perhaps a demon or allowing that to take place. Ultimately, God's the source. It's not possession, because the spirit would go away when David played the music. So what was the cause? Well, it's because of sin in chapter 13 and 15, and it's by the permission and plan of God. I think Archer's right. And it's an instrument of judgment on Saul. Well, it did bring David to Saul's attention. I'm not sure David appreciated that. Saul's fear brings David more successes, verse 12 through 16. We find that Saul's afraid in verse 12, 15, and 29. So basically this chapter, Saul is not only angry and jealous, but he's afraid. Afraid of David's success. The phrase is better translated, Saul became afraid of David's face in verse 12 and 14. So what does Saul do? He sends him away, giving a field command. And verse 13, well, the Lord is with David, as we saw earlier. It turns out that Saul was the great warrior king of Israel, and he could not even hit a target sitting across the room, unsuspectingly playing the harp. It does seem like God was in the middle of that, too. Well, David goes out and comes in before the people. The idea is military leadership, so he's leading people out and into the city, soldiers probably. And David accomplishes a lot in military expeditions in verse 14 and 15, and the result is that Saul is more afraid of him than ever, and the people loved him. I think Baldwin has the right lesson here. Whatever moved Saul to minimize David's influence failed and had the opposite effect. Application. Is the Lord with us today? Seems to be a good question for us. Not that we get spears tossed at us very often, but there's a lesson here, and Vinoy gives it here. When the Lord is with a person, he's secure no matter what forces may be arrayed against him. And when the Lord is with a person, then his enemy will fear him, even though, humanly speaking, that enemy may be in a position to do him great harm or even kill him. This is no less true today than it was in the time of David and Saul. Even today, if God's people are faithful to their Lord, they can know that in spite of the hostility of the world, the Lord is with them, and that often, contrary to what might appear to be the case, even their most powerful enemies are fearful of them. It is this abiding principle that, to a large extent, explains the extreme hostility of non-Christian political and social movements toward Christianity that is so prevalent even in our own time. Well, let's move on from Saul's fear and God's deliverance to marriage possibilities. Saul gives Merib to Adriel, the Mehothelite, verse 17 through verse 19. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter, Merib. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I, and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But at that time, when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Mehothelite wife. So there are some plots that Saul produces using his daughters in verse 17 through 19, and then again verse 20 and following. So the offer of two daughters to cause death of David by the Philistines. Wow. There they are. Well, here's Saul's offer. It was one of three rewards promised to the killer of Goliath in chapter 17 through 25, and Saul is trying to bring that reward. And by becoming the king's son-in-law, it would raise David's social status significantly. But what was Saul's motives? What were his thoughts behind this? Well, a character's speeches or thoughts in Old Testament narrative often reveal the character of the speaker. So what kind of character do we have here? If only expresses a condition. So he knew there was a catch. It's a command, an imperative clause. He wants him to fulfill the condition. He must do it. But notice that Saul keeps raising the bar for David's marriage. It's not that the victory of Goliath is enough. That was what the original agreement was. Now he must continue fighting. So let's look at David's response. Who am I? It questions that emphasize insignificance of himself, of his family and clan. It's the same response or similar response that Saul gave to Samuel when Samuel tells Saul he's going to become king. Saul says, am I not a Benjamite from the least of the tribes of Israel? And is not my clan the humblest of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? That's from chapter 9. But by keeping Saul's condition, fighting the Lord's battles, his name was highly esteemed. We find that at the end of the chapter. Well, Merib is given to somebody else, to Adriel. We're not given the reason why. It may have been the way that David responded to Saul's offer was a courteous refusal to claim any right to the king's daughter. And certainly that's what it looks at the face of value. And maybe that was sufficient, but with Saul, who knows? We know that this city-state is mentioned in Judges 7, so maybe it was a political marriage for Saul to give his daughter to someone else. And we know that the five children that are given to Adriel and Merib end up being killed by Gibeonites at their request to David because Saul had committed murder. We'll explore that later. Well, there's another chance of marriage. Saul gives Michal his wife to David in verse 20 through 28. Begins this way. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. And Saul commanded his servants, speak to David in private and say, behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then become the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servants spoke those words in the ears of David. And David said, does it seem to you that a little thing to become the son's king is... Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation? And the servants of Saul told him, thus and so did David speak. Then Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies. Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Not the best way to bring in a son-in-law. Well, David pays the bride's price in verse 26 and 27. It reads this way. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went, along with his men, and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought the foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter, Michal, for a wife. So how is Michal a snare for David in verse 20 through 28, as her dad hoped? Well, Michal loved David in verse 28, and it's repeated in verse 28. Alter mentions this. She is the only woman in the entire Hebrew Bible explicitly reported to love a man. Nothing is said about what David feels towards Michael, at least not until the return of the ark and Michael disdains David. Well, the other exception would be the Song of Solomon. Well, Saul is pleased, verse 20, and David is pleased in verse 26. Saul by Michael's love, David by opportunity to become the king's son-in-law, as we see in several verses in chapter 20. Well, what was this snare? Well, it's often used of the dangers of idolatry in Exodus and Deuteronomy. And we notice in chapter 19, Michael took an image, a house idol, if you will, and laid it on the bed so that David could escape unnoticed. David had previously eluded the king's spear and the Philistines' weapons, but perhaps he could be ensnared and ruined by a woman, says Bergen. And I think he may have been close. Well, Saul tries diplomacy in verse 21 through 25, and the goal is that the Philistines may be against him, and that's mentioned three times. What are the enticements that Saul gives to David to turn his head? Well, the king has delight in you, and furthermore, all his officials love you in verse 23, 24, 26, and 20-30. So it suggests a lot of political support for David in the court, so it will be good for him and his experience in the court because everybody's in favor of him. But the bride price is rather gruesome. The death of 200 Philistines is what David provides, although only 100 were required. And the ancient Near East, casualty counts in wars were verified by cut off hands with the Egyptians or heads by Egyptians and Assyrians. This one seems to be unique for a casualty count. But once Saul makes the bride affordable, David seems to jump at the opportunity. And David goes on to have more success and esteem in verses 28 and following. Let's read that. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. Well, the Lord's with him, plus Michael's love. What does that bring you? We'll see. When Saul saw and knew, the text begins, when Saul saw and knew David's successes and fears him. He knew that Saul had no doubt that the Lord is with him. That's what's different. Well, the Lord is with him. He evades Saul's spears twice. He's had success in military expeditions, and he's doubled the bride price and lived to tell it. That was enough evidence, apparently, for Saul. Again, Michal loved David. Saul's daughter, it had brought him into the inner circle of legitimate contenders for the throne. According to Bergen, we'll find when later on Jonathan and Abner and Saul are at a table, there's a space for David, so big increase in status. But meanwhile, Saul is David's continual enemy. So Saul was afraid. Literally, he increased or added to fear. But after seeing his success with the Philistines, his fear increases. Saul moved from fearing David in verse 5 to dreading him to verse 15 to fearing him even more in verse 29. There seems to be a progression of fear because of the successes. Well, David's enemy continually. McCarter says this, everything Saul does to thwart David's rise works ironically to David's advantage. Every opportunity Saul attempts to seize for himself turns into the end, into an opportunity for David. Well, application. Success depends on being right with God. Phillips says this, David shows us what a difference it makes to be right with God. Whereas Saul is driven through fear and envy into madness, David is led through success to the high esteem of God's people. Fanoi adds this, when the Lord is with a person, he is secure no matter what forces may be arrayed against them. And we will talk about that later. How about David's prosperity tips? Well, make good friends with people of faith, as Jonathan did with Jonathan. Be careful whose gifts you keep, robe, armor, and weapons. Choose Jonathan's, not Saul's. Jonathan seemed to fit better. And as God grants success, watch out for Saul. Those who do not seek God's will in your life and are angry at your success, watch out for them. As God grants more success, expect more opposition. And traps come in various many forms, military promotions, fame, flattery, and relationships. And that, Lord willing, is our lesson. Thank you. Next lesson will be chapter 19.